Hi, everybody. I'm a recovered compulsive eater and a member of this group. My name is Gary. I apologize. My poor friend Jordan has just heard me speak last week. When this meeting first started doing the Sunday speaking thing, I think like the third week I was one of the speakers. So I apologize. My story hasn't changed that much. I'll try to make up some new stuff as I go along. What I'll do is I'll start telling my story and then we'll see what happens, because I never know really what's going to come about when I start speaking. A lot of you know me, some of you don't. I've been an active member of OA since August 1st of 1988. And when I say active, I mean more, you know, I've been in the center of the room really from the beginning. I was brought to my first intergroup meeting probably about 6 months into my recovery, and I've been involved in some sort of service pretty much ever since. And I was taught to always be in the center of the room. That's the it's where there is safety in the center of the herd. It's the cattle on the edge that get picked off by the wolves, and I've always stayed in the center. That's where my first sponsor told me, he said, find people who are enthusiastic about recovery and sit next to them. And I did. There's a woman named Lillian in Miami who's just like sparkling with recovery all the time. I would sit next to her. She speaks with a heavy Cuban accent. So it was always funny to, you know, we never understood each other. But it was fun to sit with her. And you'll know, especially if you're a newcomer and if you go to live meetings, but even on virtual meetings, you'll meet people who are kind of like down. Oh, I can't eat this. I can't have that. I feel bad for them, but I wouldn't want to hang out with them. You know, like after a meeting, I'll sit with, you know, I'll offer some compassion and that kind of stuff. But those aren't the folks I want to be around, to tell you the truth. Recovery is a great way of life, and you want to be around people who enjoy this thing. I came in on August 1st, 1988, and I haven't eaten sugar or any of the crap that I, any of the stuff that I don't eat. I haven't eaten any of the stuff that I don't eat since I got here. I would love to tell you I've been abstinent since I got here, but that's not the case. And it's an important distinction, and one that I like to talk about when I speak. I haven't eaten sugar. I haven't eaten any of the stuff I don't eat. I haven't eaten dessert. I haven't eaten recreationally since I've gotten here in over 35 years, but I haven't been abstinent. I have overeaten the stuff that I do eat. Now, I went through a period where I was gaining weight in OA, and if this was Sugars Anonymous, I'd be a superstar. And pay attention, because there are people around you, and sometimes it's your sponsor. There are people around you trying to turn this into Sugars Anonymous as a way of justifying their own eating. Pay attention. The name of this place is Overeaters Anonymous. I've lost my abstinence three times, each time by overeating what I do eat. The definition of abstinence is refraining from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors. And I have engaged in compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors without eating sugar or any of the crap I don't eat. Or any of the I keep doing that, any of the stuff I don't eat. One time I was gaining weight thinking I was abstinent because I was only eating abstinent food. Like I was only eating stuff that was on my food plan, but I was gaining weight. And my friend Teresita, I said to my friend Teresita, I don't know what's going on because I'm gaining weight, even though I'm abstinent, thinking I was abstinent. And she said to me, well, I don't know what you're abstaining from, but if you're gaining weight, clearly it's not overeating. You know, like that. And of course, my first response, I wanted to punch her in the throat, but I didn't. I thought about it, and she was right. Like, if you're gaining weight, it means you're eating more. I'm eating more than my body needs. Another term for that, another name for eating more than my body needs, is overeating. And it is true that in OA, sometimes we don't talk to each other about that. We kind of ignore it. And pretend that everything's okay, even though we see each other getting bigger or too small. We've seen, you know, all of you who come to this meeting regularly have heard me talk about the fact that I've known 16 people to die of this disease. We literally love each other to death in a way. We will literally watch each other blow up or undereat until we die, rather than say to each other, "What's up, man? Do you need some help? Are you working the steps with your sponsor?" You know, like, and the weird thing is, people outside of OA talk that way to each other all the time. People outside of OA will say to each other, "Hey, man, you're gaining weight. What's going on?" Isn't that weird? Like, and here we're so like, touchy about that stuff. Anyhow, so I do all the time. And those of you who hang out with me after meetings know that I'm something of a, I can't think of clean words anymore. That's how bad I've gotten since my daughter's grown up. No, for years I didn't curse when she was growing up, and now I can't think of clean words. I'm something of a prick. It's true. Anyhow, so I came in. And the guy who spoke at my first meeting became my sponsor, and we did the first step, and we went through my history and gave examples of how food, I was powerless over food. And my favorite first step story, many of you have heard this story, but my dad, it's not up to me to declare him a compulsive eater or not, but he certainly had all the symptoms. And he was going, we were hiding in the Caribbean. We were both criminal. I was a criminal when I was young, and my father and his father were criminals. We come from a long line of criminals. And he was hiding from the federal authorities, and I was hiding from the New York State authorities. And he was going through a period where he was trying to not eat. So he got rid of all the food in the house. There was no food. And I had a carb craving. I had a terrible craving for carbohydrates. And I don't know about you, but when I have a craving, it's I experience. I experience it as a need. I experience it like I need oxygen. And so I had a thought. And if and those of you right now, we in this meeting, we happen to be reading chapter three, more about alcoholism, which is has four stories in it, and all four stories deal with a thought. The thought crossed my mind that with milk it wouldn't be a bad idea. Suddenly I had the thought. Anyhow, I had a thought. And the thought was that while we have no food, we have a German Shepherd, and the German Shepherd has milk bones, which are a type of dog biscuit. And dog biscuits are a carb. Don't let anybody fool you, they're a carbohydrate. So I had that thought. And once you have a thought, it's doomed. You know, like that's why today, 35 years later, I don't romance any of my food thoughts. When I have a food thought, I do my best to change my thinking right away, because if I let it ruminating there long enough, sooner or later, I'm going to lose. Anyhow, I had this thought about the dog biscuits. My second thought was, you cannot eat those. That's disgusting. And my second thought was right. They were disgusting, because I ate them and they were disgusting. And the second one wasn't any better, nor the third, nor the fourth, nor the fifth. They were disgusting, but I ate them anyway. And here's the point of that story. It sounds a little funny when I tell it, but here's the point, and this is why it's a first step story. I wouldn't have eaten those dog biscuits if I had any choice in the world. Nobody eats dog biscuits out of choice. And if you're a newcomer, or if you're struggling with your food, or if you're looking at your history with food and you realize there are things that really embarrass you or shame you, or that you wish weren't true, please know you wouldn't have done it if you had any choice in the world. That's why it's a first step story. That's what it means to be powerless. Powerless means I have no choice, that I am suffering from a craving beyond human aid. That's what the book says, beyond human aid. There is nothing that, not only me, there is nothing no human can do to help me fight that craving. And that's a, you know, that's powerless. I sponsored a guy who weighed 700 pounds. We used to have to drag a concrete bench into the meeting so he could sit. Nobody weighs 700 pounds out of choice. Nobody. If he had a choice, he would not have done that. So know that. Just know that that's what the first step means, is that you had no choice. And so then we got to the second step, and I wasn't an atheist. I wasn't agnostic. I wasn't a believer. I was just obnoxious. I was more obnoxious than I am now. And my sponsor believed in God, so I was going to argue the opposite. He believed in, so I was going to not believe, you know, so I argued with him a lot. And he said what was one of the most important things a sponsor ever said to me. He said, I don't give a hoot what you believe. He didn't use the word hoot. You know, we're a couple of guys, but you get the basic idea. He said, I don't give a hoot what you believe. He said, you're an addict. So God hasn't chosen to reveal the nature of the cosmos to you, Moses. He said it just like that. Like, who do you think you are? And it's so true. Compulsive eaters, we think there's some sort of hierarchy of addiction. Like we're like at the top of addicts. Like when it comes to addicts, we're not that bad. But like nobody would go over to a heroin addict with the needle hanging out of his arm and say, excuse me, Mr. Heroin addict, is there a God? Tell me your theology. Is there an afterlife? We save those questions for, our priest, our rabbi, or our mom. But somehow we think a compulsive eater who's an active addict is in a position to argue theology. Here's what he said. He said, if you want to get well, come to believe this. That's it. It's your job to come to believe this. And he was right. I was taught. Now, look, some of you know about some of my service positions. So I work extensively with the atheist, agnostic, and secularist service body. I know a lot of atheists who get well. And if you're an atheist, there's a way to do it. I just don't know what it is. If you're an atheist or agnostic, if you call me, I can direct you to some atheists and agnostics and to the service body where people get well. I just wouldn't know how to. I was taught if you're not even willing to believe, you don't have to believe, but if you're not even willing to believe, it's simply because you want to eat more than you want to get well, which is no big deal. Lots of us come in wanting to eat more than we want to get well. But he told me, if you want to get well, come to believe this. And that he told me to look for evidence of a loving God. And that's what I did. I looked for evidence of a loving God. And that's what I still do today. I look for evidence of a loving God, and I find one wherever I look. And I am convinced. It doesn't feel like a belief. It feels like a conviction that God loves me. And I believe he loves all of you too. But I know he loves me. It feels like knowledge. Like I know he loves me. And we got to the third step, and I got on my knees with my sponsor. And along with the third deep step prayer, I always get choked up when you get to this part of my story. I don't know why. But I got on my knees, and I was desperate. I was 340 pounds and double the weight I am today, more than double the weight I am today. And I asked God, I did the third step prayer and holding my hands with my sponsor, I was crying. And I asked God to redeem me. I don't know where the language comes from. It's certainly not part of my lexicon. It's certainly not part of my religion. And I said, God, please redeem me, make me new. And he did. It's just that simple. God redeemed me and he made me new. And it wasn't some magical like fairy dust thing. It was this, he gave me the willingness and the desire, not just the willingness, but the desire to live a 12-step way of life, to work the remaining nine steps and to live a 12-step way of life. And when I pray, I do pray not just to, I don't just pray for the willingness to be abstinent. I pray to want to be. I find the steps and the program a lot easier if I want to do it. So I pray not just for willingness, I pray to want to do it. Because wanting to is even more fun than being willing to. And as long as I know I'm going to do it anyhow, I might as well want to. What the hell? We'll have 6 minutes. Yeah. So did the fourth and fifth steps. I know I'm really fortunate. I didn't hear any of the whining and bitching. I'm sorry. I didn't hear any of the whining and groaning about the fourth and fifth steps till after I did mine. If I had heard all the complaining about the fourth and fifth steps, I might have been terrified. But I didn't hear any of that. Now I hear it now all the time. People whining about the fourth and fifth steps. They're great steps, man. The vast majority of people come to the end of their lives without knowing who they are. We're not led to this by virtue. Bill Wilson says in the Big Book, we're led to this by necessity. But through the fourth and really the 10th steps, when we come to the end of our lives, we will know who we are to a large extent, maybe not perfectly, but to a large extent, we'll have a clear sense of who and what we are on this planet. What a blessing. At the end of Death of a Salesman, the play Death of a Salesman, they're at the funeral. I hope that's not a spoiler alert for anybody, but at the end of the play Death of a Salesman, there's a funeral, hence the title. So they're at the funeral, and the son Biff looks down and says about his father, he says that he's the real tragedy. He never got to know who he is. And that's really a tragedy to come to the end of your life and not know who you are. And we get to find out, and then we get to share that with somebody in a fifth step. You know, the intimacy I had with my first sponsor and sharing my fifth step. And here's the best reason to do the fifth step. Then you get to take fifth steps. I've taken dozens of them over the years. This is the truth. They're all pretty boring. I know they're a big deal to you and you're writing them out and you're giving them and you're going to tell everybody your deep secrets. I've heard one secret in all my years of recovery. I've heard one secret where in my head I went, holy, holy, holy moly. Wow, what do I say about that? I heard one secret that really kind of blew me away. The rest of them are really pretty boring. Ask any sponsor, they'll tell you. They're really pretty boring. Because the big deals, these big, terrible things we did, they're really pretty petty. At least mine were. They're really pretty petty. And I was a criminal. So, like, I'm really pretty petty. Six and seven, I decided to try and develop character for its own sake. And what a change. Those things alone, just trying to develop character for its own sake, made a complete difference in who and what I was. To try and grow, you know, Ed Dowling is the Franciscan priest who said that line, this is the step that separates the boys from the men and presumably the girls from the women, about the sixth step. But the desire to have God make me a better man, a loving man, a caring man, a genuine desire to grow in that direction was so new to me. And not just a genuine desire to be like that, but a willingness to take the action to grow in that, to grow in that direction, a willingness to be to do those things and to see my life change that way. Man, what a great way to live. It's how I've always wanted to live. But when we were teenagers and when we were taking LSD and hanging out at Woodstock and doing all that stuff, it's what we really wanted to do. And here we are really doing it, and we're doing it to save our lives. We're doing it to save our lives. I hope I have time to tell you about the eighth step. I do. I have 2 minutes and 11 seconds. So 9 seconds, 8 seconds. So, I come from a really abusive family. I could have died at the hands of either of my parents. They were physically abusive and sexually abusive and horrific. And my mother once threw an iron at my head, a hot iron, and it hit me like here. And I always remember thinking, like, if it landed 2 inches this way or 2 inches that way, I could be blind, I could be deaf. You know, just a matter of luck that I survived. And I was doing the eighth step, and the eighth step in the big book doesn't talk a lot about forgiveness, but it does in the 12 and 12 and our 12 and 12, which I think is great. Like, I know this is a big book meeting, but our 12 and 12 is fantastic, except for the fourth step. I'm not that high on the fourth step in our book anyhow. And the eighth step, it talks a lot about forgiveness. And I was talking to my sponsor about preparing to make amends to my mother and father, and like they did this, and I did this. Like I stole $5 from them here and there, and they did this. You go to jail for what they did, you know. And like, and I said to him, and he said really calmly, he said, "Well, why don't you just forgive them like that? Like, why don't you just forgive them?" And I heard that, like, why don't you just levitate? Uh-oh, I only have a minute. I don't think I'm gonna make it. He said, "Why don't you just forgive him? Will you guys forgive me if I run over 2 minutes? I kind of need a head shake." It's okay. So he said, "Why don't you just forgive him?" And he said, "Why don't you just forgive him?" I had that, like I said, like, why don't you just levitate? And then he said, "Forgiveness is simply surrendering your right to revenge. That's it. Forgiveness is simply surrendering your right to revenge. It doesn't mean you forget. It doesn't mean if somebody's not safe, like my father, even after I forgave him and even after I made amends, still was not safe for me to be around for a couple of years because he would say things that would trigger me. You know, he would say things like, Yeah, I know I was kind of strict when you were a kid. He wasn't strict. He was abusive. Like, so it wasn't safe. So it's still like if you're a car thief, I might forgive you, but I'm not going to lend you the keys to my car. Like, I'm spiritual. I'm not stupid. It just means I don't have anything on it anymore. I don't have any, and so I have to say that, like, my mother and my father, before they passed, we got to be very, very close. My mother and I got to be best friends. My father and I had the best relationship available to us. If you come from an abusive background, I am not suggesting that you forgive. That is entirely between you, your sponsor, and your God. I am just telling you my experience and how it, what it did for me. It changed my life, and that came through the eighth step. And then the ninth step, actually taking the action. And living in 10, 11, and 12 is living the 12-step way of life. There is nothing more glorious. God, you people in this program have not just saved my life, you have given me a life worth living. If there is ever anything I can do to return the favor, please let me know. Thank you so much for giving me this time to speak.